joint meeting of the House Ag and Environment and Natural Resources Committees to order. This meeting will be held in accordance with Rule 10.01, which is posted online. We can have a roll call of the respective committees. Mr. Smith, please call the roll of the Ag committee members.
Representative Sundin is present. Representative Vang?
Present.
Vang present. Anderson?
Anderson present.
Burkle?
Present.
Eklund?
Present.
Hansen R?
Hansen R present.
Hansen J?
Hansen J present.
Cleavorn is excused. Lippert?
Lippert present.
Lewick is excused. Miller?
Present.
Nelson?
Present. Present.
Miller present, yep. Representative Nelson?
Present.
Present. Representative Thompson? We do have a quorum on our side, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. Mr. Koppel, would you take the role of the Environment Committee members?
Yep. So, Wozniak.
Present.
Heinzelman. Heinzelman. Eklund.
Eklund present.
Becker.
Becker present.
Becker Finn.
Present.
Eklund.
Present.
Fisher.
Fisher present.
Green.
Present.
Ayo.
Present.
Jordan.
Jordan present.
Keeler. Keeler. Lee.
Lee present.
That is everybody. We'll go back. Heinzelman. All right. Quorum is also present on our side.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Special thanks to Chair Hansen for joining in and educating us today on the Emerald Ash Borer. We have a very limited time, several testifiers. I'd like to hear first from the Department of Agriculture and stick with a few brisk questions. If we have more questions in time, let's submit them in writing and we'll get answers for you. So. With that, how about an Emerald Ash Borer overview from the Department of Agriculture? I don't know who's up first. Mark Abrahamson, I understand. Take it away. Introduce yourself for the record and take it away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Great to be here, members of both committees. Really happy to have this opportunity. My name is Mark Abrahamson. I'm the Director of Plant Protection at the Department of Agriculture, so I'm going to kick off a three-part presentation from Agriculture, Department of Natural Resources, and Pollution Control Agency. So we've been working together for years, of course, on Emerald Ash Borer, but in particular over the past couple of years on an interagency team that's been coordinated by staff from the Environmental Quality Board. And so a couple of products from that team are in the meeting minutes. So there was a status report that was produced and published in 2019, and then also some recommended actions that could be taken that was approved by the Environmental Quality Board in 2020. So we'll reference those throughout our presentations. I'm going to start here, share my slides, and I'm going to give a little bit on Emerald Ash Borer biology, spread, and status report. So are my slides showing?
Yes. Yes.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so Emerald Ash Borer biology, this is a beetle. They're around during the summer. The whole crux of the problem is that they're from Asia. Our trees in North America do not have naturally evolved defense to them, so they're very susceptible. The beetles themselves are not what causes the problem. It's the eggs that they lay and the larvae that hatch from them that tunnel within the trees. So it's the larvae that do all the damage, tunneling beneath the surface of the bark of trees. And what they're doing in there is they're severing the channels of the trees that move food and water. So get enough beetles tunneling around in there and it kills the trees. So when you have just a few emerald ash borers, you would never know they were there because a few emerald ash borers don't kill trees, but a few thousand do. So when you get enough emerald ash borers that have grown in a population, the trees can die fairly rapidly. And it's really, again, it's all about the numbers of emerald ash borers. When there's only a few, we don't have a problem. When there's lots and lots, we have a really big problem because they can kill trees in a hurry. If we look at it on the scale of North America, or the United States at least, you can see the green is the estimated native range of ash, and all the red dots are where emerald ash borer has been found. So you can see most of eastern North America where there's ash, there's also emerald ash borer. And so the federal government, which has been had responsibility for trying to control the spread of emerald ash borer across the country, has said at this point, you know, it's not really worth the time we're putting into it because it's across most of the range of ash. So the federal government has taken steps to deregulate emerald ash borer at a national level, which means they're no longer regulating movement of materials from states that have emerald ash borer to states that don't. And that went into effect in mid-January. And from a national perspective, I think, yeah, that makes sense. But from a state perspective, in Minnesota, it's a very different story. So we have still a relatively limited area of the state that's infested. Less than a third of our counties, only about 100 communities out of 850 communities in Minnesota, and our black ash forests in Minnesota are still unaffected. So in Minnesota, we still have a lot at stake, a lot of places where emerald ash borer is not present, and so we're continuing to regulate emerald ash borer at a state level. We have always done that in terms of movement within the state. What we've done now is we've stepped into the role that USDA used to play, and we're regulating now products that would move in from other areas of the country that are infested into Minnesota. So basically, even though it's working a little bit different, there's not really much difference in terms of how emerald ash borer is being handled in Minnesota. I just want to point out a little bit on this map. We've got a really good tracking system for where emerald ash borer is present and having impact. And so on this map, this is available online at the web address I'm showing. The red highlighted areas, those are regulated areas, and then the green areas are where emerald ash borer is considered to be kind of generally present and infesting trees. And if you zoom in on this map, you can get right down to where infested trees have been found. So we know that there are places in Minnesota that just haven't been discovered yet that have emerald ash borer because that's the way it works. It takes a few years to find it. But we're really good at finding and places where it's having impacts and getting that published. So this is really a good resource for people to use to make management decisions because these are the places where emerald ash borer is having impacts now, and you can use this to guide decision making regarding them. Emerald ash borer, Department of Ag, we're all about trying to stop the spread, slow the spread, keep it from spreading as long as possible, along with regulating that is also a big communications job. So we do a lot of work to try to get that message out to the public. That's one of the big problems with emerald ash borer is that firewood is a prime mover and anybody can move firewood and we can't regulate everybody. So we have to get to them through outreach communication. And my experience has been you can't tell people enough. We have to keep repeating the messages so that they're keeping in mind that this is still a thing that they need to worry about and take steps to avoid. Really, a lot of our effort in terms of spread has been focused on communities. And the reason for that is emerald ash borer goes with people. And so communities are the first places where it shows up, and it's the easiest place for it to get spread from. So we really focused our efforts on the community level and trying to help communities in terms of like what steps can they take that not only help their community, but that take measures that are going to keep emerald ash borer from growing and spreading out of that community. So we've got a really nice resource, again, online for communities, like what are the specific steps you can take? How do you implement a good management plan for emerald ash borer? And again, our goal in this is if we can attack it in communities and have really good actions going on in communities, we can keep the spread from, we can slow the spread to other areas of the state. For communities, really, it's a tough road for communities. We think about emerald ash borer infested trees. One of three things is going to happen with every tree that gets emerald ash borer. It's going to get removed. It's going to be treated with an insecticide, which can preserve it, or it's going to die and fall apart. For communities, that last option's not an option because it's a hazard for communities. So really, that leaves communities with two choices. They treat trees or they remove trees, and that's what they're going to have to do with all the ash trees in their community. again, slowing the spread is a really good thing. And so this is, at a very generic level, spread of Emerald Ash Borer in Minnesota compared to the spread rate in the rest of the country. So this is the instance where it's good to be below average, and that's where we've been. Our spread rate in Minnesota has been much slower than what we would expect from the national average. Probably a few factors at play there that, you know, it's hard to suss out exactly what the reason is, but whatever the reason is, we're glad it's been that way. And the longer we can keep it that way, the better. The longer that it takes for Emerald Ash Borer to get to a community, that's the best management, is to not have Emerald Ash Borer for as long as possible. So that's at spread rate at a very generic level, which, you know, tells us something about Emerald Ash Borer and where it is. But, you know, there's also the question of impact. And so what I'm going to try to do now is get a little bit the impact of communities. And so this is a very general model of Emerald Ash Borer population growth and tree mortality. And so the crux of it is that when Emerald Ash Borer first gets to a community, the population is small and there's no impact of the trees. But that population eventually grows very quickly, and then the tree mortality will follow along rapidly behind that. So if we look a little bit closer at tree mortality, this is the tree mortality again, but it's on a different scale. So now we're looking at healthy forest out here on the left side of the axis with 100% ash trees alive, going down through time to where we don't have any ash trees left. So these are tree loss curves or tree removal curves for ash trees. And there's different models that could be used to model that rate at which trees are lost within communities. And so I'm showing these as kind of a faster one, a 12-year model of tree loss, and then a slower one, a 20-year model. So what we've been doing over the past couple of months is checking in with our communities in Minnesota that have Emerald Ash Borer and trying to find out where they are on this scale relative to how long they've had Emerald Ash Borer. And so what we're seeing, each of these dots is a community that we've been communicating with, and this is where they are now, with how many years they've had Emerald Ash Borer found in that community, and what percentage of ash trees that have been removed versus what are remaining. So what we're seeing is we've got a few communities that were smaller, didn't have a lot of ash trees, that removed them pretty quickly. But most of our communities they're kind of all over the place, but they're clustering around this 12 and 20 year tree rate loss curve. So they're, you know, decent estimates of how fast we can expect trees to be lost in communities over time with Emerald Ash Borer present. So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to take spread and I'm going to take loss of trees within communities and put them together to try and come up with an estimate of overall impact to communities over time. And keep in mind, this is an estimate. So we're taking a lot of data here and putting together. In doing that, I have to make some guesses. And so, you know, this is my best estimate, but it's an estimate. So this is where I think we are now in time and where we're going. So we've got years here across the bottom. And the y-axis, this is the number of ash trees we're estimating are going to be removed per year in communities. And the green line is with a 12-year loss rate in communities. And the blue line is with a 20-year loss rate in communities, so slower. Here's where we are in 2021. The take-home point is that my estimate is that we've got a long ways to go in terms of tree loss in communities. And over the next 10 years or more, we may be going upwards in terms of how many trees we're losing in communities. So basically, we've got a long way to do with Emerald Ash Borer. This is just communities. There are other situations as well, forest land, for instance, that Department of Natural Resources will talk about. And so at this point, I'm going to transition to Department of Natural Resources.
Next up would be Amy Kate Sherber. Identify yourself, please. Continue.
Yes, thank you. Good morning. My name is Amy K. Kerber. I work for the DNR, Division of Forestry. I'm the Legislative Affairs and Outreach Supervisor. Thank you for inviting me today. Today, what I want to talk about is ash trees and forests in Minnesota, Emerald Ash Borer's impact on those trees and forests, and a little bit of an update on DNR activities. Next slide, please. So first of all, where are ash in our state? There are a lot of ash in Minnesota. We estimate about 1 billion ash trees. And you can see from the map on the right where they are. The map illustrates a concentration of ash in our forest by the shaded areas, and then the dots represent the percentage of ash in community forests. Let's focus for a minute on those community forests. Mark was just mentioning them. 20% of the trees in our communities are ash. That's 1 in 5 trees. If you add all of those up across the state, that's about 3 million park, yard, and boulevard trees in our community forests. And we know emerald ash borer has a high kill rate, right? It kills all the trees once it's infested in a community or in a stand, a forest stand. And it even kills trees down to 1 inch in diameter. So those community ash trees, all those trees eventually will die from emerald ash borer. And I know we're all often concerned about climate change impacts. Thinking on those 3 million ash trees in our community forests, they're estimated to mitigate 7.8 million pounds of atmospheric carbon and 2.96 billion, almost 3 billion gallons of stormwater capacity. So the loss of ash trees is certainly going to widen the gap in meeting our greenhouse gas emission goals. And it's also going to increase things like salt and sediment and put them into already struggling ecosystems and landscapes. We can expand those concepts, of course, out to the billion ash trees in our greater forests in the state. Next slide, please. Our community forests are at the greatest risk and in the greatest immediate need. Helping communities now helps contain EAB and slow the spread to other cities and out to our ash forests. As Mark just showed on a map earlier, we have EAB in communities, but not established in across the million acres of ash forest that we find in northern Minnesota. So it's important to try to keep it away from that forest as long as we can. Cities are continuing to tell us that they need help. They need help to do inventory so that they know where ash are in their communities, to develop management plans that will guide treatment, removal, and replacement of ash. And most of all, they need financial resources to do all of this work. And if communities don't get financial and technical assistance, we will end up with communities full of standing dead ash trees. And I think later today, you're gonna hear something from Karen Zumach that'll illustrate a little bit more of the community impact. Next slide, please. So looking a little more specifically at what communities need, they need resources and support to do the inventory, to make the management plans, to treat trees or remove them, replace them with diverse trees, educate residents, and they need to also provide help to homeowners. Now, the DNR works with a network of urban foresters to lend technical assistance to municipalities, but financial support is needed to help these communities respond to this crisis. I wanted to take a minute here to just touch base on treatment. When we're talking about treatment, we're talking about a tree injection of an insecticide like emamectin benzoate. It's something that can be used about every 2 to 3 years on a tree. It's highly effective in a way to address and kill EAB in a tree. It's not a neonicotinoid, and the cost of it, which is, of course, a consideration. If you think about an average-size ash tree, about a 20-inch diameter tree, costs about $120 to $240 about every 2 to 3 years. So, all right, that's a number. How is that in relation to removing the tree, which is another alternative? On public land, looking at estimates that we've received from cities, we think it's about $1,000 to remove a tree that size. Now, a homeowner might pay between $1,000 to $4,000 to remove an ash tree on their property, depending upon the size and location of that tree. So if we look at treatment as a way to keep the ash alive and on the landscape and providing all the benefits that tree can provide, that's very important. The other thing that we're doing by treating is that we're spreading out the financial impact of the removal as well as the waste impact. And we're gonna hear a bit about that later from PCA. Another added benefit of keeping ash on the landscape longer is they're continuing to sequester carbon and provide all of the other climate change benefits as well. Next slide, please. So we have had some recent support for communities. Thank you for that support, because it has come, a big part of it's come from the legislature. In 2019, we've received $2 million to support communities in recent years, with $3.5 million recommended or pending from LCCMR. We hope that comes through. The 2019 combined funding of $1 million that you see there between general fund and LCCMR support has been distributed to 35 communities to support planting of thousands of ash trees that have been removed and then replaced with diverse species. Those projects are going well, and in lieu of like listing all the details of what's happening, I provided a handout that's attached to the meeting, the 2019 grant update handout, so you can see the communities and how much money they received and their status. And if any of you want additional information on those communities or other grants, please just let me know, and I'm happy to get you those details. The 2019 general fund dollars for $700,000, that money is set to expire, and we've been hearing from communities that they need more time to finish the work. The seasonality of removing and then replacing trees in the following spring or often fall, which is a great time to plant trees, compounded with COVID, means the communities are just not able to get the work done in the time we originally had, and so we do need to have an extension on that allocation of funds. The $1 million that we received just this past fall in the 2020 bonding session, we're excited that we just issued the call for applications. That's out on our website, and those applications are due March 22nd. So if you know a community in need, have them reach out and put in an application. The financial need, despite the recent funding, still continues to be high for communities. Just to illustrate that, on that 2019 general fund set of grants, those pass-through grants, the DNR received 51 full applications for $3.4 million as requests, and we had $700,000 available. The EQB EAB report recommends $8.5 million a year until 2030 in community support to help combat EAB in our cities and towns. Next slide, Mark, thanks. So we're going to transition, talk a little bit about ash forests outside of our cities. We're in a pretty unique situation here in Minnesota. We have more ash than any other state in the country. 1 billion ash trees spread out on 1 million acres of forest, of which the DNR manages about 170,000 acres. And ash is the second most common tree in Minnesota. While we can learn something from places like Michigan or Wisconsin, New England communities that have already had ash, the sheer volume and spread of ash in our state puts us in uncharted territory. Excuse me, territory. Try that again. For those of you that live in the southern part of the state, most likely the ash that you're familiar with is green ash. That's in upland sites or maybe in communities, cities, and towns. When we're talking about ash forests, we're really thinking mainly about black ash swamps that call northern Minnesota home. And that's where we find about that those billion ash trees. And it's in these ash swamps that the biggest challenge is ahead of us. Next slide. So ash forest management, the goals are pretty simple, they're pretty straightforward. We want to keep forests as forests. We want to do that for a variety of reasons, for sustainable forest management, for climate change, and a host of benefits. But in ash forests, that's a little bit tricky, as ash is a dominant species in wet, swampy environments, where ash is uniquely suited and has an ability to serve almost as a water pump that helps regulate the water level in the area. And so as we look at managing them, we really have to think about maintaining the hydrology on the site, because as these ash die or decline, if trees are not on those sites to help absorb water in these wetland sites, that unused water that's not used by the ash trees will start to move, and it will move off the site, affecting other parts of the greater landscape as well. We need to think about minimizing habitat and biodiversity loss. As foresters are looking ahead, they are planning ways to best support these unique collections of plants and wildlife found in these black ash swamps. And as we all know, reforestation is key. It does present some challenges because these sites are often wet places. But based on research and recent experience, we're discovering reasonable replacements. We're looking to floodplain species like hackberry or swamp white oak, balsam poplar, cottonwood, maybe even silver maple, and some of them do show promise. Reforestation is necessary here to prevent invasive plants or other trees from establishing. And the way we can deal with that now, we're using harvesting as a tool in these ash forests to open up spaces that will allow new trees species to grow and establish ahead of EAB. Of course, a challenge within harvesting is that we need to ensure there are markets to support harvesting so that we can support the establishment of other tree species in these ash forests. In August of 2020, the DNR Division of Forestry updated our forest management guidelines, and we are really working to try to implement all of these management goals to get ahead of EAB in our forests. Next slide, please. So I mentioned harvesting and its connection to ash markets as a way to make sure we can keep using harvesting as a tool in ash management. So existing markets for ash are not very broad. As we look at urban ash trees, the main option is energy. And looking at the ash forests, we see markets in firewood and pallet and paper. There's some sawlog or veneer and some solid wood products like flooring, but those are much smaller volumes. We have a billion ash trees on a million acres. Current markets cannot absorb the future wood. In fact, current markets are not necessarily taking all the wood that's being offered. Ash harvest rates remain constant on DNR lands for the past few years, despite more ash being offered. Ash is, the ash forests we have are dominated by smaller diameter material, which limits the processing opportunities or the interest of different manufacturers. As recommended in the EQB report, we need to find innovative market solutions and financial incentives to encourage ash in our existing markets and spur new markets, along with a plan for ash waste. My last slide. It's been 12 years since we have had EAB was first discovered in Minnesota. We know a lot more about EAB and how it interacts with forests, and we know the biggest impact from EAB is yet to come. Many players are needed to make this a success: counties, private woodland owners, industry, cities, tribes, researchers. No one agency can do this alone. The DNR is committed to the interagency effort and to working with partners to combat EAB. Looking ahead, we must continue our collaborative efforts. By continuing to slow the spread, we allow the costs and impacts to be absorbed over time. Community assistance is critical to slow the spread, and ash use and waste solutions are needed to help maintain ecosystem benefits for our forests. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kerber. Next up, we have David Benke from the MPCA. Mr. Benke, would you please identify yourself and continue with the presentation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Good morning. My name is David Benke. I'm the Director of the Resource Management and Assistance Division at the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I just want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this important issue. As we've already heard, emerald ash borer is a problem that crosses the responsibilities of a lot of different agencies, and so working together is imperative, and we've, I think, done a great job of that so far, and we'll continue to do what we can there. As we worked through the plan that the EQB coordinated, it became pretty clear for the agency that our emphasis needed to be on the environmental impacts of removal of the trees, but also at the same time figuring out how to manage what could become a huge waste stream, or how we could maybe help move that into products rather than treating it as a waste. And for the agency, we also looked at it from a community standpoint rather than the forest standpoint, because we work with those same communities on managing waste and connecting with them for that seemed a little bit more doable. We also recognize the overall impacts of the Emerald Ash Borer for the state's forests everywhere from an environmental standpoint, but our work centered on that community. Next slide, please. So when we look at managing waste, we always look at managing it through the waste management hierarchy, moving it up from the disposal to the recovery. When we look at managing wood waste from Emerald Ash Borer, we also look at a similar hierarchy, trying to recover the most value from the trees and provide the most protection to the environment. You can see from this slide that tree preservation is at the top of the list. Treating the trees will allow us to not only slow the spread, but it'll keep the tree doing what the tree does best for the environment, for the community. Second, if we need to remove the trees, we should try and make sure we can harvest them for products. Lumber, firewood, mulch, other things have been mentioned, but those products also have value, and using the value from those products to help offset some of the costs might be important. But remember, when you remove a tree, you've got to replace it just to replace the environmental benefits. So you got to make sure that it's just not removed or you lose those benefits if they aren't replaced. So for the other options, as you move down this hierarchy, composting is available, but when we look at the yard waste sites across the state, the volumes that we're talking about for potential removal needs could overwhelm some of these small sites. So we need to coordinate that in terms of volume so that they aren't overwhelmed. We talked about biomass, and biomass is a huge need in terms of the use of the material, generating both steam and electricity from the trees, and it creates energy that is very useful. And the last thing we don't want to see happening is that we have open burning. Just piles of trees burned will cause significant environmental impacts and lose the value that's in those trees. So when we think about it, the most preferable options have the best environmental outcomes, and the least preferable have the significant consequences or potentially the least benefit. Using this hierarchy, everyone needs to work together to put EAB back to use. The next slide, please. When you take a look at it visually, you can see that the options that we're talking about include timber harvesting, mulching and composting, potentially biochar, wood products, biomass heating and energy, and the recreational or home heating fuel options. Timber harvesting probably isn't something that we'll see in communities unless they have larger stands in parkland or something like that that needs to be managed. But boulevard trees and so forth are a little bit different from that harvesting standpoint, so then we might need to look at that as a different type of collection method, which I'll talk a bit more in another slide. The next slide, please. So one of the things that we're trying to do is to look at ways we can implement the EQB's report. We're looking at coordination with the communities. One of the options that we think is something that we could do was work through our Metro Policy Plan that works on all waste, and it would allow us to collaborate with the Metro counties and stakeholders to help develop a plan. We think this planning is a good opportunity to pursue some type of strategic approach that could position us to manage the wood waste. This would allow us, I think, to take our traditional partners, the waste managers, and connect them with other traditional wood product and managers at compost sites and elsewhere. We think that dialogue could help us. We're going to prepare our solid waste policy plan for the Metro, but we also work in Greater Minnesota on planning. And so I think we should look at targeting those counties with potential infestations as we prioritize the planning with those counties. I think that connection with wood product suppliers, organics waste managers, and our county partners could help yield some ideas and some plans that could help manage this waste. We also need to take a look at research and innovative uses that are out there. You know, we have to look for community-based programs and see how they could help us. There are programs out there that are harvesting wood from the cities right now, and we might, you know, want to try to see how we could increase that capacity. We've also heard that there's a new level of research going on with biochar for from wood waste. The biochar, if you haven't seen it, it's a charcoal-like product, and it can be used as a soil amendment to help soil retain nutrients and water, improve the fertility of the soil, and can aid in sequestering carbon. And it may have other benefits that have yet to kind of look at. So we got to keep track of that research and see what's going on there, because if that takes off, we need to make sure we're encouraging the use of ash in that production of biochar rather than other woods. We also need, I think, to look pretty hard at our wood use for both heating residentially and recreational fires. That could be a way to manage ash. Right now, about 1.5 million cords of wood are harvested annually for that purpose. We currently see about 12% of that as ash, and if we could move that up with the trees that we have to remove, that might also be a way to create a system that assures that that wood gets seasoned and dried for fuel or recreational purposes, and reduce the impacts of wood smoke that we see when people burn non-seasoned or wet wood. So that might be a way, if we can push into that area, to recover and handle two of those issues at the same time. The next slide. I think it's been said, you know, our agency remains committed to continue working together to make progress on the recommended actions from the EQB report. We need to make sure that we have coordinated efforts with the communities. I think we really need to understand the role and cost of treatment to slow and stop the spread of EAB as we think about and provide that financial and technical assistance. You know, for the agency, prevention is our top method, and making sure that people understand that it might be a combination of both, but those benefits of those trees environmentally, the longer we can keep them on the landscape, the better off we're going to be. This is going to cost. You know, there's no doubt that it's going to have a cost no matter what we do, and those costs seem to be unavoidable. We just have to decide when we incur them and who pays for them and how. Getting the highest value out of the material might help offset those costs. So thinking of ways to recover the material for products, I think, is the best. We got to maintain the existing options and invest in more to develop products and expand the end-of-life management of the wood issues. I appreciate the time today, and thank you. And that concludes the presentation from the team here. So I think we can take some questions.
Thank you, Mr. Benke and company. We've got about 10 minutes open for questions. I see one hand up. Representative Lee, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this question is for the DNR regarding the funding that they have received around in the presentation, I believe $1 million from bonding. Knowing that the bonding bill was passed in October and the proposals are due in March, I wanted to see what has been some of the outreach effort and reaching out to the different communities throughout the state of Minnesota and letting them know about the program.
Mr. Benke.
If
Ms. Gerber.
Thank you. I'll take that one. Thank you. Thank you, Chair and Representative Lee. That particular grant, the bonding dollars, and I'm not sure if you've had an opportunity to see the posting. It did just post February 1st. It is focused on trying to serve diverse communities and communities that might be at risk for social justice concerns. And I don't have a list in front of me, I'm sorry, of all of the outreach efforts, but I know that we are actively using social media, Twitter, Facebook, a variety of means to try to get it out to all communities. And then we have direct communication with community leaders that deal with natural resource management. And so we're using those channels as well. And if you'd like, I'm happy to do a follow-up. And then, of course, traditional news releases and those types of pieces as well. I'm happy to provide a little bit more detail if you want to know specifics beyond that.
Thank you. Representative Anderson, you had your hand up. But it came down, evidently. Representative Becker Finn, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just wanted to speak to a little bit. You know, we talk a lot about the cost of just the immediate dealing with the trees that are infected. And for example, the city of Roseville, which is one of the cities I represent, you know, it's estimated that the cost is going to be well over $1 million. And that's just for city-owned trees. And so I think, you know, the coordination that's required between not just state agencies, but also cities and then individual homeowners is a huge ask. So, you know, I know some of the numbers, you know, 3.5 million is actually not that much when you think of one city budget in the entire state being impacted by over $1 million. So I'm just trying to make sure folks realize the scope of this problem and what it's going to take to think about it. One question I had, it was touched on a little bit during the first presentation, but you know, the kind of thing that I see a lot that I think of as a legislator, because we've been talking about EIB for a very long time, are especially this time of year when people are looking for firewood or sometimes for homeless encampments, sometimes, you know, people post things on Facebook. And what I'm observing is that the general public is really not aware of some of the restrictions and the things that we need to do to stop the spread of EIB. So just wondering sort of what the plan is and what more we may be able to do to really get that message out to everybody and, you know, not just the press release way of communicating the stopping the spread message. Hopefully there's some reporters listening to this hearing today.
Does anyone care to respond?
I can take that one, Mr. Chair. This is Mark Abrahamson, Department of Agriculture. It's a hard job.
Please, Mr. Abrahamson.
Thank you. It's a difficult thing. I mean, like I said, we can't do enough outreach, really. And it's a matter, I think, of competing for people's attention. I mean, we've got a lot of things going on in life. And so, you know, for me, I think about it all the time because it's my job. For a lot of people, this isn't top of mind. And so the best answer I have is that it's something we just keep repeating and trying to find different ways, unique ways to advertise and reach people, including social media. So, but it's really a daunting problem.
Good. Thank you. Anything further? Okay. Hearing none. I guess I would have one quick question as far as the BTU content of the ash trees as opposed to aspen or let's say pine. Can anyone speak to that? The BTU content of the ash.
Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mr. Benke, please.
Dave Benke with the PCA. I don't have that number right in front of me, but we can get that back to you in comparison. We can take a look at that from a bunch of different species.
Okay. Thank you very much. We have time for one quick question from Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is kind of two parts, but maybe Mr. Abrahamson can answer one and Mr. Benke. But I'm curious if there's been any consideration of, I saw compost and mulch mentioned. Has there been any consideration of using some of this product for bedding for livestock at all? And if, you know, the drying down process of that product would kill the emerald ash borer as you dry down that product. I was thinking, you know, in that sense, there could be some kind of a revenue stream built too. I know the livestock industry is always looking for bedding materials. So has that been considered at all?
So who wants to grab that one?
I could start, Mr. Chair, and then maybe
Dave Abramson.
Yeah, thank you. So I would say that, yes, material does go into the mulch stream, and so that is an existing use. I haven't heard specifically of livestock bedding as one of the purposes, but I do know it's, there's an amount of material going into mulch. And yes, if you grind it up into a fine enough grind, you can kill the emerald ash borer larvae in that. And so that's actually a treatment method that then the mulch can leave the quarantine because it's considered not infested anymore.
Thank you.
Mr.
Any further response?
Mr. Chair,
not connected with the dairy industry on that yet, but I do think that in the livestock industry might be an option. I think we can follow up on that and see where that might go. That is a need that's out there. You know, the bedding is being looked at in a lot of different materials for that purpose. So we can follow up with the larger facilities that we work with and see what concerns they might have or if there's an opportunity there.
Thank you. We're running a little close on time here. We have time for one more question from Representative Anderson, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question to either any of the testifiers. We're all hearing stories about the price of lumber skyrocketing. And does that at all change the equation as far as using more ash for dimension lumber, things like that, as the price of lumber just keeps going up dramatically?
Okay, Mr. Benke or company?
I can give that a go.
Ms. Gerber. Gerber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative. That's a great question, and I wish I could say yes. Unfortunately, because ash in Minnesota is a smaller diameter wood than what you might find in Michigan, where you find larger trees that can be used for saw logs and veneer and dimensional lumber at a higher rate, that's not what we see in Minnesota. So the size and then the limited access, because ash is on wet sites that have to be harvested only when the ground is truly frozen to avoid damage to the soils and the environment, it makes the wood less predictable, less reliable for the mills, so they tend not to rely on it in those situations. And so where I don't think we're going to see an increase in interest for ash lumber as a result of that price increase overall.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Lippert, if you can do this in 1 minute, get an answer in 1 minute, the floor is yours.
Yes, very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was pleased in the last presenter's presentation to see mention of biochar. I'm just curious if I know the Natural Resources Research Institute in the University of Minnesota Duluth doing a lot of work related to biochar. I think it has tremendous potential in both agriculture and in, you know, water treatment, dealing with PFAS, things like that. Just wondering if you're connected with them and also thinking about ways that we could advance this research and support it.
Who wants to tackle that one?
Mr. Chair, Dave Benke with the PCA. That is exactly where we have seen the research starting to come out of, and that's where we've started to make some connections to see what type of applications it could be for. And then, as I mentioned in the testimony, we want to make sure that if it does start to take off for those applications, that we include ash for the production of the biochar. And that might be an additional research opportunity to make sure that the char that is made out of the ash is suitable for these applications.
Thank you so much. If the testifiers would to stick around for a little bit. We have some more questions that we can't get to right now, but maybe we can pick them up at the end. Next up, we have a presentation from the Shade Tree Advisory Committee for the next few minutes. Karen Zumach, Director of Community Forestry. Please identify yourself and continue with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Zumach. I'm the Director of Community Forestry for Tree Trust, and I am the current president of the Minnesota Shade Tree Advisory Committee here in Minnesota. It is a committee that's composed of public and private sector tree professionals, interested citizens, and nonprofit organizations from across the state, with board members representing the Minnesota Nursery and Landscape Association, League of Minnesota Cities, Minnesota Forestry Association, Society of American Foresters, among others. We're tasked with just, educating and informing all Minnesotans about the benefits of a healthy community forest, and we're happy to be here today to talk about EAB. So let's start with a definition. When we're talking about our urban and community forests, we're talking about the trees that line our streets and shade our homes. These are trees that are planted to improve the places where we live. So if you think of a tree-lined street, or you think of a park, or you think of the tree in your yard, these are the trees that we're talking about that make up our urban and community forest. So if you think about your yard as a typical Minnesota community, and you had 5 trees in your yard, you could expect to lose anywhere from 1 to 3 of those trees to emerald ash borer. That's what it translates to as a loss for communities. So if you're a community like Alexandria here in this picture, a pretty significant amount of ash trees in their community, they can expect to lose thousands and thousands of trees over the course of the next 10 years. That's what EAB is doing to our communities. Its devastation comes in the form of not only canopy loss and benefits loss, but also in the form of straining municipal budgets. EAB is a big deal. It's considered the most destructive forest pest to ever reach North America and has killed hundreds of millions of trees. We have the most to lose here in Minnesota, as the DNR had just mentioned. We have 1 billion ash trees, and those trees are providing important environmental services to our communities and to our state. It's what we like to call a predictable disaster. EAB has been coming for years. It's been here for over a decade, and we knew it was coming. So unlike this tornado that's left the scar across North Minneapolis back in 2011, we'll see the scars of EAB for at least the next 2 generations due to canopy loss. It's been here in Minnesota for 12 years, probably longer, and is now in 26 Minnesota counties. It has also been found north of us in Winnipeg, so we're nearly surrounded by EAB. The DNR estimates that there are nearly 3 million ash trees growing along our streets and in our urban forests across the state, and we'll lose every single one of them without active management. If any of you remember Dutch elm disease, this is Dutch elm disease on steroids. In 2019, it marked a turning point for our efforts. We've been working with the legislature, with representatives, with the agencies to try to arrange for funding for communities to manage EAB. And in 2019, when we first received funding, that was the start to help communities manage this pest. These efforts must continue in order for our communities to manage EAB where it is. And like Amy Kay said earlier in her DNR presentation, keep it out of where it isn't. And it should be noted that in 1975, when Dutch elm disease funding was first allocated, there was $1 million the first year and $28 million appropriated the next biennium. There is a precedent here within the state of Minnesota to help communities manage their urban forests. It's imperative that we provide comprehensive access to all the tools in the toolbox for municipalities, including inventory, treatment, management, planning, preservation of those high-value trees, removal of low-quality trees, and then replanting with a diverse variety of species so we can really maintain those ecological services. So I just want you to think for 1 minute about an ash tree standing in a park or along a street. That tree is providing, like Amy K. Kerber said, benefits to our community. So that 18-inch ash tree is standing there and mitigating stormwater, sequestering and avoiding carbon, doing all these things just standing there. And when we think about trees as climate change adapters and mitigation strategies, there are very few things that do it as well as urban trees do. They increase in value over time, providing more and more benefit as they get bigger and bigger, and they are critical to our climate change goals here in the state of Minnesota. Research has shown that when invasive species like emerald ash borer come through, it takes nearly 2 generations for the tree canopy to be restored to its pre-invasion pre-invasion levels. Those trees are super important when we're talking about climate change. So I've talked to a few city foresters from across the state, and I've got a little bit of a snapshot to share with you of what they're dealing with. So in St. Paul, what could be arguably called the epicenter of the EAB crisis in the state, they're saying that with 100% of their untreated ashes now presumed to be infested in St. Paul, the city has had to make the difficult decision to prioritize the removal of infested trees over stump grinding and replanting. There's that delay. If these funding levels remain static, as they have for the most part of over a decade, with the exception of a few funding infusions, stump grinding and replanting could lag behind removals for up to 10 years. With over 11,000 ash trees remaining on city streets, the impact of these removals without adequate funds to replant will be a blight on the city and its residents. In Winona, the wave of EAB infestations has given its city foresters, busy teams, tons of time-sensitive work to bring down dying trees before they fall. And that's limited the amount of time and budget the tree crews can spend on planting and other tree-related issues. In Rochester, they're now generally totally infested throughout the community. Their funds are drying up and forcing them to spend more time on emerald ash borer response and give up on more traditional services. This year is the first year they don't have funds to replace ash trees that have been removed. They're increasing the number of trees in their treatment program beyond what their management plan had called for in order to hold off replacement and removal costs in order to work with the money that they have budgeted. They relied on grant money last year to get replacement trees planted. Minnesota has seen this before. We've invested hundreds of millions of dollars in today's money to support the replanting after Dutch elm disease. This is precisely the type of investment we need today. We're proposing a multi-pronged approach to assist in this battle, and we ask that you support sustained urban and community forestry funding to protect our community forests from future pests and disease of at least $2 million a year. Provide assistance in the form of grants to cities and towns to access all the tools in the toolbox for the next 10 years at the cost of $8.5 million per year to help rebuild and reclaim our urban forests. Continue to support the research being conducted in the Northern Black Ash Swamps through the DNR, the University of Minnesota, MFRC, as well as within tribal communities. Find ways to incentivize ash. Creating an urban wood resource hub would be helpful, and we cannot burn or chip our way out of this wood issue. Reuse makes good sense, and ash wood is beautiful. A furniture maker here in St. Paul noted that ash is an underutilized hardwood for custom furniture. It works very well and is a fantastic alternative to oak with more character. And if it were readily available, I'd use a lot more of it. Lastly, provide support for Serve Minnesota's pilot AmeriCorps program, the Community Forestry Corps, which has currently placed 18 AmeriCorps members with nonprofits and municipalities across the state to assist them with their urban and community forestry programs. Right now, there are members serving and playing critical roles in communities like Duluth, Warren, Laverne, Rochester, Winona, Eagle Lake, among others. These are important positions that are helping communities rebuild their urban forests. One thing we know for sure is that time is running out. Communities are truly struggling to keep up with EAB management. We need to manage this pest where it is so the important research can continue that has come so far since 2002, and we can manage this pest better. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that presentation, Mrs. Zomack. Are there any questions regarding the shade tree issues? Representative Morrison, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to, I guess, particularly thank the chairs for convening this meeting and to the testifiers for their work and continuing efforts to educate Minnesotans on the issue and to address it. I really appreciate Ms. Zumach reminding us of the state's robust response to Dutch elm disease and how quickly the state acted. This is incredibly alarming. I'm struck by the maps that show the breadth of the spread in the state already. This is clearly a statewide emergency. This should be ringing alarm bells across the state. So I'm grateful to everyone for raising this issue today. And boy, we need to act, and we need to act quickly. Thank you.
Thank you for those comments. Any other questions or comments regarding the shade tree issues? Okay, hearing none, we actually have a couple minutes. We can go back to a question from Representative Eklund if he wishes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize for having to step away earlier when the DNR and the PCA. Ms. Kerber, on the wetlands issue, that's where I live. That's I would say a vast high percentage of the black ash trees are in District 3A. And I've heard wetland issues, I've heard concern, but I haven't seen any plans. So I would really like to see if you'd comment on the plans that the DNR has for dealing with this, because if this gets into our black ash forests, this wetlands are gonna be ruined. So I'd like to hear about that. And then the other question I have is for Mr. Benke on the transportation issue. Are you using sealed containers to move this stuff? Because otherwise we're just looking at transport. I'm thinking about what's been ground up and such for energy projects. What kind of transportation are you using to transport this across the state of Minnesota? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Amy Kerber first, please.
Okay. Thank you, Chair, Representative Eklund. So, as you said, addressing these wetlands and the removal of living ash in those wetlands is significant. They serve an incredible purpose on the landscape that we all know. What we're trying to do, and I can certainly provide you with more detail later, and you would like that, about our ash management guidelines, is proactively use harvesting as a means to work in those swamps ahead of establishment of EAB so that we can remove ash, open up spots in the canopy, and establish diverse species and continue to promote that throughout these swamps so that as EAB comes in, we have established forests that can begin to expand as EAB becomes a bigger issue. Of course, that just makes keeping EAB where it is in our communities, unfortunately, and out of our forests even more critical so that we have more time to do that work.
Thank you, Ms. Gerber. David Benke?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The transportation issue that was spoken to there is resolved by if the product is ground down to a 1-inch minus size, it destroys the larvae. But the transportation issue really is something that the Department of Ag, you know, is in charge of in terms of what can move where from quarantine counties and so forth. And so when we're talking about developing these markets, we're trying to work within that matrix so that we don't cause that issue of moving it around. But just from the, you know, the fuel standpoint, if the chips are of that size, or for compost or for mulch, that would reduce the ability for that larvae to still be spread.
Thank you. Ms. Representative Eklund, do you have a follow-up there?
Well, thank you. And living where I do with a paper mill 4.5 miles from my house, if you walk out on my road right now, you'll see wood chips laying on the road from the trucks transporting them by. So that is, even if you... I would like to see some kind of guarantee that is the larvae are not guaranteed, because I know that's not possible, but I would like to see that the data that shows that the larvae is destroyed. And Ms. Kerber, thank you for your comments, and I'd like to see that report too, because I've been hearing the same thing for 5 years, so I'd like to see that there's some real progress being made. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, well, we're out of time on this. I see Representative Heintzman has got his hand up. If you could hold that question to the end, we'll try to make time for that. Right now, we need to move on to the EAB research presentation from the University of Minnesota. If Chair Hansen would please host the remainder of the testifiers.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. Next up, we have Rob Vanette with the Terrestrial Invasives Institute at the University of Minnesota. Mr. Vanette, welcome, and state your name and who you're with for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dr. Rob Vanette. I'm a research biologist with the U.S. Forest Service, and I'm the director of the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center, which we call MITPIC, created at the University of Minnesota in 2014. Today, I'm going to provide just a very brief overview on some of the research that has been and is occurring at the university on emerald ash borer. This research began the moment EAB was first detected in Minnesota in 2009. And really from the outset, it's been a very collaborative effort, primarily with the Minnesota Department of Agriculture, the DNR, cities, different private landowners, and the Forest Service. Both the University of Minnesota and MITPIC are what we call national leaders in terrestrial invasive species research. And the studies conducted here are unique, really emphasizing the distinctive features of Minnesota's forests and climate. So today, what I'd like to do is just limit my remarks to results from research on black ash, some new management options, detection techniques, and then briefly touch on some recent studies that MITPIC has initiated. So when EAB was first detected in Minnesota, there was really quite a bit of concern about our black ash forests, even though that detection was quite far away. Black ash is considered a very unique resource for its economic, ecological, and cultural significance. I want to emphasize, as you've heard from a few testifiers, that after already 12 years, EAB still is not in these black ash forests, and we're grateful for that. U of M research has demonstrated that black ash trees are a keystone species in lowland forests. They're critical for regulating water levels and providing a very unique habitat for wildlife. Black ash are the dominant tree species at these sites, and they're most likely to be replaced by shrubs, particularly invasive buckthorn, if they are lost and no active management occurs. However, large clear cuts in black ash forests can be as harmful as EAB itself. So what we've learned is that through extensive research, we have recommendations now to preserve the services that these forests provide by planting trees that are resistant to emerald ash borer, such as swamp white oak, American elm, or Manchurian ash. My own research on the cold tolerance of emerald ash borer suggests that establishment and spread of the insect will be challenging in parts of northern Minnesota where extreme winter temperatures fall below minus 20 to minus 30, fairly common for this part of the state, and we're likely to see that this weekend. Where EAB does occur in Minnesota, U of M research has been critical to support two of the primary management options, sanitation and biological control. Our studies have shown that quickly removing and destroying infested ash trees slows the buildup of EAB by 60% with disproportionate benefits to uninfested trees. This approach is the primary management strategy for many communities around the state. At the same time, Minnesota has been an early adopter of biological control with tiny, non-stinging wasps. You've already heard a little bit about MDA's biological control efforts. Well, research from the University of Minnesota provided confidence that these wasps would be able to survive winter, particularly in southern Minnesota, and disperse extensively once they've established. So fortunately, emerald ash borer is not yet present everywhere in Minnesota, and finding it early gives land managers more time and options to achieve very desirable outcomes. Research at the university has demonstrated that woodpeckers are very efficient at finding emerald ash borer 2 to 3 years before the insects would begin to kill trees. As a result, searching for woodpecker activity has become the standard approach to detect emerald ash borer across the state. Other methods, such as prism traps or branch sampling, are also very effective, but they can be very time-consuming and costly to implement. So lastly, I want to acknowledge some of the ambitious, more recent research on emerald ash borer conducted through the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. So MITPIC teams are exploring the use of naturally derived insecticides that can protect high-value trees, minimize risk to beneficial insects, and create a form of herd immunity that would benefit untreated trees. Another team is identifying the wide array of fungi that are associated with emerald ash borer, discovering some species that may infect and kill EAB. A third team is using virtual reality to explore the acceptability of potential EAB management options to recreationists, a project that acknowledges the complexities of managing ash forests for multiple uses, like camping and hiking. Numerous individuals have contributed to the success of all of this research, and I want to be sure to acknowledge Drs. Brian Akema, Bob Blanchette, Catherine Bushley, Randy Kolka, Brian Palak, Matt Russell, Ingrid Schneider, Rob Slesak, and all of their students, staff, and collaborators who have made such tremendous progress in a short amount of time. I also want to especially thank the Legislative Citizen Commission on Minnesota Resources, the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund, and you for your support of all of this research and the Minnesota Invasive Terrestrial Plants and Pest Center. And just as a quick final comment, I also want to acknowledge that there is plenty of research that's within the recommended 2020 ENRTF packet, and we're hopeful that that will move through the legislature. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Vanette. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Vanette, for this presentation. This is really interesting. You talked a little bit about the effects of extreme cold temperatures in Minnesota on EAB. I was hoping you could give us a few more details about how extreme temperatures are impacting the spread of EAB, and can you also comment a little bit about how climate change is affecting the temperature of Minnesota and what effects climate change will have on EAB spread and management?
Dr. Vanette.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's a fantastic question, and I could probably give a 30-minute seminar easily on that very issue. So let me just give you some of the highlights. The first point is that from several years of work on this, we know that when temperatures get down to around minus 20, we can expect about half of emerald ash borer to be killed. When it gets to minus 30, we're looking at about 90% mortality. And how that's playing out is that when you look at the spread of emerald ash borer across the state, you'll see that it's generally more common south of a line that follows Interstate 94. And what's really interesting about that is that as you go north of that line, temperatures are quite a bit colder than the rest of the state. People will comment about Duluth. Duluth is the northernmost occurrence of EAB, but there's a considerable lake effect. And Superior keeps that city warmer, and which has allowed EAB to keep its foothold. Climate change is obviously a huge concern for us. We're starting to see those classic Minnesota winters less and less often, and that creates more and more opportunity for EAB to spread to new areas. But what we're also learning is that climate change is having some very complex impacts on the environment. And so polar vortexes, like we're about to experience this winter, still happen and may happen with an increasing frequency, meaning that although on average our winters are warmer, we may have 1 or 2 days with very extreme cold temperatures. And those are very hard to forecast. So it makes it very difficult to do long-term projections on EAB. Sorry for the long-winded answer.
Representative Jordan, follow-up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Vanette. So is there more need to study the effects of climate change on the spread and mitigation and management of EAB and just generally our urban forests?
Dr. Vanette.
Mr. Chair, absolutely. We're very concerned about all the future conditions that will affect emerald ash borer. Climate is certainly among them, but we're also concerned about the future composition of our forests. The key point that key advice that we provide is that we really want to see a greater diversity of forests. The challenge is how to do that without creating opportunities for new invasive pests. So yes, lots of room for research.
Thank you.
Representative Heintzman, I've seen your hand go up and down and up and down, so I don't know if it's still there or Representative Heintzman. Okay, well, I guess we're going to move on. Hold on just a second. Thank you, Dr. Vinette. Next, we'll be moving to talking a little bit about wood waste. And so we have Ken Smith from District Energy.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm going to share my screen here. And hopefully you can see that. So thank you for the opportunity to speak with you this morning about tree waste. It's probably appropriate that I'm at the end of what's been excellent presentations on this very important topic, given that we are where many ash trees end up going at the end of their life, and that is into the use of energy.
Mr. Smith, if you could just introduce yourself and who you're with for the record.
Yes. So I'm Ken Smith. I'm the president and CEO of District Energy St. Paul. I wear a few hats, also Evergreen Energy, and which we have an affiliate, Environmental Wood Supply, that handles tree waste and makes biomass from that we use at our facility in downtown St. Paul. The tree waste comes from a variety of sources, as you've heard today. This is just some examples of the kinds of volumes that we deal with. Some of this is from storm damage. Some of this is from private woodlands and areas where waste has been dumped. You see the ones that are snow. Most of that tree waste there is EAB, actually, and that was in the metro area. Some of this is from storm damage, say from Faribault, and areas like that. So we end up dealing with a lot of tree waste from the region, and we use it to make energy. We use it in a combined heat and power facility downtown St. Paul. We heat about 32 million square feet, over 200 buildings, including the Capitol complex, is heated by this facility through a hot water district energy system. About 50% of our heat on an annual basis comes from tree waste. And it's used here at this facility. This facility was actually built in response to the experience from Dutch elm disease, where there was so much tree waste during that time. There was challenge managing it. The region still had tree waste to deal with, even as Dutch elm disease impact was winding down. And so this facility was built to, one, deal with tree waste and also displace coal and generate both renewable electricity and heat. We work with many businesses. Hundreds of businesses utilize our wood yard and this facility to manage tree waste. This is some of the zip codes of businesses, but it represents hundreds of businesses across the region. We are seeing a significant increase in the amount of tree waste that we are managing. This is from 2015 through 2020, and the trends are clear. You see Hennepin County at the top. That is the number one source of material consistently for us, but even Hennepin County has grown about 20% since 2015. And you'll see counties now on there like Anoka. Anoka doubled in the amount of material that we experienced from 2020 to 2019. And in counties like Sherburne County, you can see about 10 times in 2020. It varies from year to year because some of this can be from storm damage, for example, and so you'll have an uptick from a particular area. But clearly, the amount of material that we're dealing with is on the rise.
And Mr. Smith, I'm not sure if we're seeing the slides. Are other people seeing the slides?
No.
Okay, we're missing the PowerPoint. If you can.
Okay. Are you see it now?
Now we do.
Okay, I apologize for that. Okay, so this is just to show the images, this facility downtown and material that we are utilizing and zip codes from across the state. I apologize for that. So this is the waste volumes that we're dealing with As I said, Hennepin County consistently number one for us, but increasing quite dramatically. Anoka County increasing dramatically. And so you're seeing it across the board, across all of our counties, particularly in the metro area, we're seeing a significant increase, and I do have a graph for that as well. We also receive material that's in the form of raw tree waste. So this material is the county material is actually ground up in those counties and brought to us. And so there was a question earlier about how does this material move around? If it's within a quarantine, it doesn't need to be ground up, but if it's moving either in with outside of the quarantine or between counties and you're passing through a non-quarantine area, it would need to be ground to 1 inch minus, and that's how we handle the material that we're managing. We also receive material from small wood chip haulers. This is typically ground up in the metro area. If somebody's removing a tree from a yard or something from near a business. And then raw tree waste is brought to us, and you can see it is increasing quite dramatically there as well. And this is coming from quarantine areas within the metro area. That's in tons. I also have the same data in the form of 22-ton semi-trucks. So that's the largest tractor trailer that we can have on the road. And you see that we have nearly 12,000, and this is just from these counties, nearly 12,000 tractor trailer loads of wood chips equivalent. If we were to line that up, it would extend from the state capital to Detroit Lakes. So it gives you a sense of the amount of material that we're dealing with on an annual basis. This is the seven county metro area from 2012 through 2020. The blue lines, if we continue at the same trend, is for 21 and 22, you can see the volume amounts. For the seven county metro area from 2012 to 2020, the amount of material that we have dealt with or that we're dealing with now has doubled. We can't say that all of that is from EAB, but we certainly have seen a significant increase in the amount of tree waste that is coming in as EAB. And when it comes into the form of wood chips, it can be mixed together with a variety of things. We don't know if all of it is EAB, but the material, the sites that we go to and we handle raw tree waste or it's coming into us in the form of raw tree waste, clearly there's a lot of ash wood in that in the material that we're handling. I show that projections for 21 and 22. I also show it dropping to zero in 2023 and 2024 because currently we do not have a contract to continue to generate electricity past 2022. And once that's done, then the facility will need to shut down. We are working with Xcel. We've reached agreement with Xcel, and we have legislation that's going to be coming forward. It's in the revisor's office for this session that will be needed in order to enter into an agreement to continue operation of the facility. This is my last slide, and this is the raw tree waste. This makes up somewhere around 10 to 15% of the amount of material that comes into the wood yard. I know some of you have visited the wood yard at, near the Capitol, or it's actually down by Pig's Eye, so not too far from the Capitol complex. We have seen a dramatic step change in the amount of material that we've been handling. We've been handling tree waste for 18 years. We're dealing with the amount of tree waste we've never seen before now over that 18-year time frame. So it is a significant increase, and it's going to need some place to go if we don't continue to operate this facility. I will stop there and see if there's any questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, are there any questions? Well, people are thinking, the first appropriation for Emerald Ash Borer from the Minnesota legislature was in 2009 with $2 million out of the Outdoor Heritage Fund. And that occurred, as many things often do, when the very first detection occurred during the legislative session. So we acted. And then for 10 years, we really didn't invest anything in terms of money to communities from the state. And local governments, property taxpayers had to pick up that cost. And we did provide some dollars through LCCMR for continuing research, but meanwhile, the bug kept moving. and the investments that we started to make 2 years ago have some impact, but we see that the demand is very high. We have, as Representative Morrison pointed out, we have a mountain of wood in front of us that's going to be coming. And we have difficulty. This affects every corner of the state, and it affects every agency and every community. And we're going to have to try to figure this out quickly, because we've waited too long. Prevention is better than cleanup, and early response kind of is the best way to try to get things before they're established. So I know Chair Sundin and I want to make sure that we're working together and make sure the agencies work together, that we try to get a response ready. I don't know, Chair Sundin, if you want to say anything while our members are thinking.
I'm just pleased that there's so much interest from some of the new members, and really I've got some pretty heavy concerns on using the waste wood properly, or you know, efficiently somehow. And then I'm also very interested in replacing those trees as they come down as best we can, you know, with a replacement variety. I don't know what that would be, you know. I imagine it'd be from town to town or from location to location on just exactly what the most suitable replacement tree would be, but we need to get on this. We need to get on this now.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, I didn't catch this, and I apologize. First off, I want to thank both the chairs of the committee for hosting this. I didn't do that earlier. I'm glad we got this set up, because this is such an important topic to the state of Minnesota. Mr. Smith, do you purchase, is there a market for this waste wood, or are you guys just taking it because they need a place to get rid of it?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eklund, the material comes to us in different forms. If it's brought to our wood yard in raw form, it's dropped. There's not a cost for it to be dropped, but it comes in. There's a lot of different ways that it comes into the waste streams. It can come into a wood yard in a community, for St. Louis Park, for example, or some of the county sites or community sites that it comes into that. So how they handle it, many of them are free. Some of them may have a small fee. So when it comes to the wood yards that we're managing, there's no fee for that. It's dropped off, and then we take it from there and make energy from it. If it's already pre-processed, depending upon if it's meeting specification, there's a small payment that's made for that. Sometimes it covers the transportation. It certainly doesn't cover everything when it comes to the processing of that tree waste, but it helps defer some of that cost. And because it's pre-processed for us, we don't have to put as much effort into making it into biomass fuel.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Smith, thank you. And therein, I think, is part of my trouble that I have is I see that I appreciate that you're taking raw wood in there, but I think there we got to take a look at what the transportation issues across maybe different county lines are. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. I have a question for back to the researchers. We heard about cold, but what about on the top end? What is the heat? What is the heat that is needed to kill the bug? So if you're treating either raw wood with temperature or with the chips with temperature, what is the temperature that needs to hit in order to kill the bug?
Mr. Chair, I'll take that question. I don't have that precise number off the top of my head. I do know that standard temperatures that are used for kiln drying are exceptionally effective at killing this insect, but I don't know if there's a critical temperature like we have with cold on the hot side. So I'll look into that and get back to you.
Members, are there any other questions? Representative Sundin, Chair Sundin, excuse me.
Thank you, Chair Hansen. I was just wondering, when we convert that wood into energy and burn it, can you talk about the emissions from wood smoke as compared to coal or any other electric generating sources?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Chair Sundin, the material is burnt at a very high temperature, about 1,200 degrees, and so it is burnt very cleanly. There is back-end controls on our facility. Of course, we have to have an air permit that's regulated by the MPCA. And so we have electrostatic precipitators for to pick up material in the back end. So it's actually a quite clean burn if you get it high enough temperatures, and that facility is designed, it was designed to handle tree waste of this form.
Okay. If I may follow up.
Chair Sundin.
How about the ash, the residue? Is that a marketable material at the end of the day?
Mr. Smith.
Mr. Chair, Chair Sundin, the ash, actually, there's two different forms of ash. There's bottom ash, which falls through the grates, and there's top ash, which is actually collected through the pollution control, emissions control system. Both of those are highly valued for soil amendment. So we work with the program that gets that material to farmers, and they apply it on their fields for soil amendment.
Thank you.
Members, we do have, in addition to the personal testimony, we have written comments that were submitted and are posted from the Minnesota Forestry Association and the Partnership on Waste and Energy. I don't see any other questions. I have one additional one, kind of getting to the both the dimensional lumber and also the furniture question. So to the scientist, how deep do the larvae go into the wood? So is it, when they're working on the tree, is it just that outer layer between the bark and the actual wood, or do they go into the log? Because that would seem to have an impact on the desirability of the lumber and or furniture.
Mr. Chair?
Dr. Vanette.
So the life cycle of emerald ash borer is intimately associated with the bark, you are correct. So they spend most of their time there. As they get ready to overwinter, they will burrow into the outer wood just a bit to create what we call a pupal cell. That's maybe an inch to an inch and a half beneath the surface of the wood. And so that is a concern. But where the insects are depends on which stage of their life cycle they are in. But they do not go into the heartwood whatsoever.
And so if we want to look where we might have the infestation, we've got to look for woodpeckers, that they're an indicator, Dr. Bennett?
They are better at finding emerald ash borer than we are. That is true, Mr. Chair.
Good. Chair Sundin, I don't see any other hands up. Representative Jordan, and I want to make sure one last call for Representative Heinzman, because I believe I did see his hand earlier. So, Representative Jordan, if I'm going to do one more call for Representative Heinzman, because I know he had his hand up earlier. Okay, Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Vanette. My question is for you, and it's related to my question earlier regarding climate change. As we see species, and it's about species and indicators for, I've had constituents, I represent parts of Minneapolis, and they've reported seeing different sorts of birds and species in, you know, Northeast Minneapolis than they've ever seen before. I know we've seen more pleated woodpeckers, for example, I feel like this winter than we have in the past. So as climate change also shifts our tree line and moves species around, how does that impact the dispersal of other pests? I mean, emerald, we're obviously the focus of this committee's emerald ash borer, but I know as we're seeing the shifts in species across the state, you know, we see hardwoods moving farther north, we see other species moving farther south. Can you talk a little bit about what that means? I think especially as we're looking at other indicators beyond just traditional testing. Are there any other indicators that we need to be thinking about as climate shifts our landscape and ecosystem?
Dr. Vinette.
Mr. Chair, again, it's a very wide-reaching question. So you're absolutely right. So we're very concerned about shifts in tree distributions, and those are changes that are going to happen fairly slowly over time. So we are looking for some of the more short-term indicators. But what's interesting is that as you talk about, as maples, for example, progress farther north, that's happening as pines are being lost. And so the challenge with climate change is that there are winners and losers, and that's true for invasive species as well. What we are seeing are opportunities for things like new invasive weeds to move into the state, and they're changing their distributions, new pathogens, some serious concerns in forestry that are now moving in. But we're also concerned about other species that may have a foothold here and perhaps won't do as well under future climate change. And so we have lines of research that are trying to sort out who the winners and losers are and which parts of the state will experience those changes.
Thank you. Representative Jordan?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Dr. Vinette, I could talk to you about this all day. So I heard you say you could give it another half hour talk on the effects of climate alone, and I might hold you to that. But can you give us some examples of what some of those winners and losers species in Minnesota might be as a result of, especially as it pertains to your research?
Dr. Vinette, the last question.
So, Mr. Chair, I want to be careful because it does get pretty complicated pretty quickly with respect to all of the details. But I do want to highlight one of the ones that we're very concerned about is the mountain pine beetle. This is an insect that is native to Western North America but does not occur here. We're very fortunate, but because of the warming winters, that insect has escaped the limits to its native distribution. It's jumped the Rocky Mountains and is now moving through the forests of Canada towards us. And were it not for climate change, or more accurately, the warming winter temperatures, that insect would not be the threat that it is. And so that is one that we're very concerned about and we're keeping a very close eye on.
Thank you. And members, I think our time is up. I want to make sure we thank all of the presenters today and the folks that they work with on trying to arrest this pest. We have work to do, members, a lot of work to do on this particular issue. So thank you, and looking forward to working together. Chair Sundin, any final comments?
Just a word of thanks to Chairman Hansen for pulling this together, and thank you for the committee for your attention to this very important matter.
We are adjourned.